I'm Lights, Camera, Jackson. This is episode 2 of a special podcast event series, Cinema Stories. Thank you for listening. Hope you're doing well. Cinema Stories is where I bring on fellow colleagues, film critics in the industry, to talk about favorite in-theater, movie theater experiences. Remember going to the movies? It seems like forever ago, but it wasn't that long ago. Hopefully, we'll be back to going to indoor movie theaters very soon and getting that true cinematic experience. We'll talk about some of our favorite stories and experiences and favorite movies we saw in theaters, and also what's going on right now and our thoughts on what could happen in the future of the movie-going experience. My guest on this episode of Cinema Stories is a friend and a colleague, friend of mine for at least a decade, member of the Online Film Critics Society, contributor for filminquiry.com, jim-dixon.com. He is Jim Dixon. Thank you so much for being on Cinema Stories.
Thanks for having me, Jackson. It's great to talk to you.
I was trying to think the other day, when was the first time that we met each other? It was about a decade ago, either at the end of 09 or early 2010 at some screening. It was either like Grown Ups or Shrek, or it was one of those.
It was, I think, at the end of 2009. I'm pretty sure you were at the Tron Legacy screening. And that's one of the first times I think I remember talking to you. I probably spotted you at one or two before, but of course, you know, was afraid to approach a celebrity of your status. It's been 10 or 11 years easily.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that. The Tron Legacy one was... I got to go to it during the week because I think Yogi Bear was also coming out that week, and I needed to see both of them before reviewing them on TV, so I was able to go to Tron Legacy during the week. A lot of screenings here in upstate New York, especially in the early years when I was on local TV and things were happening. A lot of family films. I really enjoyed doing all the different trivia events and the contests and things like that for animated films on Saturday mornings.
You know, with films that are you know, angled at children, particularly, I think it's really important to see the movie with kids because they don't always react the same way grown-ups do. And when children really get into a family movie and you hear them laughing, it's a heartwarming experience, and I've always enjoyed that. It also really tells me whether or not the filmmakers are connecting with the audience that they really need to connect with. I've seen children look incredibly bored at some screenings. When they're too quiet, you know, they're getting fidgety. But when you hear them burst out laughing at stuff, even if you think it's a stupid joke, but if the kids respond to that, it's so much fun to watch them having a good time. And it really makes the experience all the more enjoyable. And when I'm trying to think about how I'm going to approach reviewing a movie, if I know they nailed their target audience, and I said, look, the six-year-olds are eating this up, you know, I have to take that into consideration and say, yeah, okay, you know, it's 60. I think this is like, maybe I think it's silly, but the kindergarten crowd loves it. And that's what's more important. So I've always preferred to see family films with kids.
Yeah. One of the ones that sticks out in my mind was the two of us, another colleague of ours, Amy Biancoli, a film critic for many years. We went to the Pirates Band of Misfits. And I just remember, even though it's an animated film and Aardman stop motion, I just remember laughing so hard. And the security guys afterwards were like, wow, you laughed so hard, all of you, during this movie.
You were a lot younger then. I remember thinking that the movie was funny. I did enjoy that. And I think the kids were initially a little startled by the look of it, and then they got into it.
Yeah, I agree.
I remember hearing a lot of laughter in that movie. And it was very instructive to me to see how you were responding to it. Because like I say, you weren't, you know, you were not the grand old man of 21 that you are now.
With the deeper voice and the even more philosophical thoughts on films and such. Yeah,
you were shorter then too, but.
getting into this world of movies, what you may not know about Jim is that you were a lawyer for many, many years and then got into this whole film critic movie world, but you've had a love of movies your entire life. Were you surprised in the early years of going to these screenings, whether they were with audiences or just private screenings? It was just the two of us and Amy. What those experiences were like?
I had never had the experience of going to strictly a press screening where there were literally only anywhere from one or two to just a small handful of people in the room. And I mean, that was a kick in the head. I felt very special and very privileged. I do sometimes, I have a love-hate relationship with audiences, as you know. I've dealt with some audiences who frankly, you know, some people should not be allowed out without their keepers. And there are sometimes I felt that audiences were not well behaved, did not respect the movie or the screening experience. But for the most part, I think movies are a communal experience, and I like to see them with audiences. And with press screenings, you're a little more inhibited. I've caught myself belly laughing a couple of times at press screenings and wondering if I should be that loud. But there's nothing bad about not having to stand in line.
Oh yeah, that's true. That's true. The last screening we went to was Wendy, and yes. It was just the two of us at a theater, like 10 in the morning at one of the theaters in Albany, New York. And, I don't know, because things were starting to happening. The news was starting to come out about the coronavirus and what could happen. It felt a little odd to be there. I'm not going to lie. It felt like, yeah, maybe we're not going to be doing this much longer because of what's about to happen. And that was the last time that I went to that specific theater.
Yeah, I remember. I had very much the same feeling at that one. We were already hearing a lot about this. There was already speculation about, you know, would theaters and things like that be closing? The thought did float through my head. How badly do you want to be in a space that's, you know, used to being crowded with people? Yeah, it was at that. There was a slightly nerve-wracking aspect to that, and I did have the suspicion that this might be the last of these for a while.
Yeah, yeah. What has been going on the last couple months with you? Obviously, we've chatted personally and texted back and forth, but as far as you watching movies and watching some of the newer releases that have been coming out on VOD and streaming, what has the at-home viewing experience been like for you?
Well, actually, my comfort viewing has often been going to, like, older stuff. Believe it or not, I actually binged on T.J. Hooker reruns the other weekend when one of the cable stations was doing a marathon. And I was like, you know, just actually did binge out on a really not overly intellectual 80s cop show. And I watched a lot of Perry Mason reruns. My wife Susan has been discovering rediscovering the glories of BBC classic mysteries and has become a big Hercule Poirot fan. So we've been watching a fair amount of BritBox. It's really been very, very hit or miss. Of course, right now, this is oddly in some ways one of the best things that's ever happened to the streaming and video on demand market. Because they've got product and people actually, I think, need it to keep their sanity right now.
I agree. And also, you've been going back watching, you got to be watching some classic horror movies and some of those, because I know that's one of your specialties, one of the things you're passionate about with Dark Shadows and many other shows and things over the years. What are some of the horror movie memories you have of being in a theater, some of the early horror movie films that you got to experience even before you started becoming a professional film critic?
The first horror movie that I saw in a theater was almost certainly House of Dark Shadows back in, that was 1970 or 71. It was, the movie was, it was a low budget movie based on the ABC daytime soap opera Dark Shadows, which was a horror supernatural soap opera. They used much of the cast from the TV show, and we were all very excited about that movie. It didn't occur to us. Everyone in my neighborhood watched Dark Shadows. We did literally run home from school to see it at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And now it was on a big screen. We didn't know that this thing was made for $300,000 and shot in 28 days. And was like, they had like virtually no money. We didn't get any of that. We thought that these people were as big a movie star as anybody in the world. And we were so excited to see Dark Shadows on the big screen. I saw it at the State Theater in Schenectady, New York, which no longer exists, but it was just down the street from Proctor's, big screen, ornate ceiling. And that first shot of Jonathan Frid as Barnabas Collins, everybody's favorite vampire antihero, that first shot of him on the big screen, there were several hundred little kids in that theater, and everybody just burst out in applause when they saw him. And then we were very surprised at how much more violent the movie was than the TV show. And there is a scene where Barnabas actually attacks and kills one of the heroines, who we were also used to seeing every day on TV, literally tackled her onto the floor while his servant looks on helplessly. And people were screaming. I mean, that was my introduction to horror movies on the big screen. And it was a theater full of young screaming kids and young adolescents. I don't think we were prepared for Barnabas being quite that sinister. House of Dark Shadows also had far more graphic makeup and makeup effects than we were used to seeing in a lot of movies, and certainly on the TV show. The blood drinking, you could actually see the blood. We were all like totally shocked, horrified, and completely delighted. And there was no turning back.
I remember you telling me about different horror movies you've gone to recently, but that audiences can still easily get scared by what's happening on screen and have those kind of out of your seat moments.
We went to see the opening night of Ouija a couple of years ago. Now, this is not a great movie. Ouija is just a spook show. It exists on a very, very primal level, but we saw it at Regal Theater in Clifton Park. I swear that every cheerleader at Shenandoah High School was there that night, and so this was perfect. We were sitting in the front row with a bunch of teenage girls who were all shrieking on cue, and it just made the movie so much more fun. And of course, the audience feeds off itself. Yeah. I mean, you're feeding on the anxiety that your neighbor is having, and it's like everybody's screaming on a roller coaster ride. It was great fun. If I look back on it now, no, the movie does not stand up in the bright light of day, but it was a lot of fun to see that in a crowded theater full of extremely nervous teenage girls. One of the most entertaining experiences at a movie theater I've had in years.
That's cool. And same in the vampire world and all of that was the Twilight Saga that young girls were into when those movies were coming out. I remember Colony Center, the Colony Regal. It was a night in June of 2010. And I remember Despicable Me, Universal had set up a screening for me to see it at 6 o'clock. So I wasn't, to be honest, looking forward to Despicable Me because I didn't think it looked that great from the trailers. So I went into the Despicable Me knowing that at 7:30, I was going to literally walk across the hall to go see Twilight Eclipse. So I'm watching Despicable Me and I'm laughing so much because the minions are so funny and the story's really nice. And the credits start and I'm looking at, you know, my watch or a phone or something, and it's getting close to 7:30, and I'm like, I got to get over to Twilight Eclipse, but this is still so funny, and I got to see the credits for Despicable and what the minions are doing. And then I raced as fast as I could after the credits were over across the hall to see you guys with Eclipse, and I know I missed the first scene.
Yeah, I remember explaining that to you afterwards, what you, because you did walk in late. I remember that. Well, you didn't walk in, you ran it. And and it is like Jackson was on a tight schedule that night. Yeah. I had seen the previous one, Twilight New Moon, the first commercial showing on opening day. And there were only two or three, this theater was sold out. There were only two or three men in the theater. And I was the only one with no date. And if you want to feel a little weird, that's the way to do it. I did see one young man from Union College walk in with five co-eds. And I had to admire his enterprise. He escorted four or five girls from the college to see Twilight New Moon. And I thought, you know, this is a young man with a head on his shoulders. Mm. He clearly has a future. Mm. And that was one of the strangest experiences I had ever had, because there were probably 300 or 400 women in that theater and like three guys.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, and he had to pay for all the tickets for those girls, too, so he must be making some money somehow.
He might have considered it a worthwhile investment, but...
Jim Dixon is my guest right now on Cinema Stories. One of the crazy experiences I remember having with you at a screening, and there are different kinds of advanced screenings. There are screenings where we get invited, we get reserved seats, which is really nice. We can show up 5 minutes beforehand, and all that's good. There are other ones from GoFabo and advanced screenings, and we'll get into those a little bit here on this episode. But there are also nationwide screenings that studios decide to do, or decided to do, and they do cost regular ticket price money. But one of those was Million Dollar Arm, which is this Disney baseball movie from 2014 with John Hamm. And the thing about that night was we went to the Regal Colony Theater in Albany. Got there, it was me, it was you, it was Susan, your lovely wife, and it was my cousin Roman. And we were there and waiting for the movie to start in about 20 minutes or so, and all of a sudden the fire alarms go off. And we're fire alarms go off, and we're like, okay, what do we do? So we decided, instead of going out the door into the hallway where we thought it would be crazy because a 13-screen multiplex, so many people would be coming out, we decided to go down the fire exit out the side and down those stairs. And I remember when we got outside, you said, if this ever happens again, we are not taking these stairs and going down this side fire exit.
Yeah, that was felt a little bit lost, and that was a lot of walking.
Yes, yes, it was. As it turned out, down the hall, they were doing the RPX. They were putting in the stuff for the RPX, and something had leaked or something happened to set it all off. But I remember that, and that was a bizarre experience. But as I recall, I remember hearing from you that something happened at Sherlock Holmes similar to that.
Very similar, and I think that was, also at Colony Center. But yeah, the fire alarm went off in the middle of the movie, and having to evacuate with my ex and my kids. That was weird. And then of course when we come back in, they started the movie, and it had been running while we were out. So now we'd missed several scenes, and then they ran it back. But to several minutes before that showing took forever.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure it did. And with Sherlock Holmes, you know, that's the kind of movie where you need to see every scene of the film in order to have it all make sense and add up.
Oh, yeah. We came back in and he's like jumping out the window. We had no idea what had happened. And it was and it's like people started, howling. And the projection is finally, well, it was, oh, that's right. They weren't here. But that was I've been to at least three movies in my life that were interrupted by fire alarms, and I guess after you've been you have enough decades of movie going experience, it's likely to happen.
So in talking about the different advanced screenings, sometimes you sit in the seats and it's reserved and it's nice, but sometimes we've been contacting each other over the years because they have audience screenings that sometimes they primarily want audience members, but they allow the critics to go to them as well if you have a printable pass from a site like gofabo.com or advancedscreenings.com. We have stood in those lines and waited a few hours with the movie fans. I mean, it's a different experience, but yet it's kind of fun.
It is. You have to remember to wear comfortable shoes because you're going to be standing up for an hour or so before you get in there. I remember one, I think it was one of the Transformer movies. I was trying to save you seats in there because you couldn't get there that early.
That's right. That's right.
And they had an overflow crowd, which we should mention that these things, they frequently do. They often turn quite a number of people away, and they were turning people away for this one. And I'm trying to hang on to these two seats for you. And everybody's kind of, people kept looking at me like, are those seats taken? And I'm like, yeah, they're taken. And the people are like, okay, so where are they? And when you finally got into that theater, which was only a couple of minutes before the movie started, I was so relieved because I was really feeling like the least popular man in the world at that point. That can get kind of stressful, but it is those audiences are usually very excited.
Yes, yes. As I mentioned with my guest Jeffrey K. Howard on the last episode of Cinema Stories, people will do anything they can to see a movie for free and to go to these screenings for free. And we see the same people all the time who get the passes from the GoFabo or advanced screenings online and wait in line for a while. You know, we see the same people over and over again, and it's nice to see them. But yeah, I remember that night I was doing, I was just starting the East Greenwich Library movie night, which we've both been a part of over the years. And that was the second one, I think. And I didn't want to bail on that because that was at 6:30. But I knew the Transformers screening, which was through Time Warner Cable. It was a little different. I was at 7, so had to race from the library to get to Albany to be at that Transformers screening. I remember getting up to the back. I can still picture that. And but you had saved some good seats, and people were like, "Hey, it's LCJ. Hey, now we know why you saved the seats, Jim. Now we know." But I still appreciate you doing that.
Oh, no problem. I was not, in fact, actually torn apart by an angry mob, so it worked out okay.
What are some of the other, over your many decades of your movie world, obviously, we got to mention that you were at a screening, a local premiere screening of The Place Beyond the Pines in 2013, which was the film with Ryan Gosling and Eva Mendes and Bradley Cooper, and Bradley Cooper came to town. What was that experience like? I've been in a few screenings over the years where celebrities have popped in, but obviously Bradley Cooper, one of the biggest stars in the world. Seeing him at that screening, what was that experience like for you?
That was very exciting. And in fact, he showed up, the movie, they were already screening the movie at that point. And one of the publicists was kind enough to come in and actually whisper to me that if I wanted to have a chance to do a Q&A with Bradley Cooper, I should come right then. Mm-hmm. And so I went out there, and there were a few members of the press who they put into a side room, and Bradley Cooper came in with Emery Cohen and Derek Cianfrance, the director, and they took some questions, and I believe I asked Bradley Cooper a harder question than he really wanted me to. That was very exciting. I had seen some of the location shooting while they were in Schenectady. I had not met Bradley Cooper at that point. Interestingly, my daughter was interning down at Schenectady City Hall that summer, and she did actually meet him several times. But I had never actually laid eyes on him before. And I'll tell you, this man has got the bluest eyes you have ever seen. It's like blue spotlights turned on you from across the room. But he's very intelligent. You spot that right away. He's a very intelligent, articulate young man. And it was very exciting. I had just been seeing him on the screen a few minutes before, and there he was right in front of me. I had already gotten to meet Emery Cohen and Derek Cianfrance and several of the locals who had been in the movie. And that was a very, very exciting evening.
Yeah, yeah, I concur. I got to meet Bradley Cooper at Critics' Choice the following January and tell him how much the upstate New York Capital Region appreciated him coming to film Place Beyond the Pines. It was a huge deal. It's always a big deal when movies come to film in upstate New York. And then we get to go to these screenings, whether it's Place Beyond the Pines, whether it's Salt and the Other Guys. Sony released those back to back over a couple weeks. I remember at one of those two, I forget which one it was. It might have been Salt. And everybody was waiting to see if Albany got credited in the credits. And I don't think it was for one of them. And people got mad, but it was in the other one.
Yeah, I don't believe there was a credit for the Capital District for Salt. Of course, that was actually a second unit shoot. Angelina Jolie was there and actually did some of her own stunt work.
Yes.
But actually... Martin Campbell, who directed that movie, was not even present when they filmed that. That was all a second unit stunt crew. And if you live in either D.C. or the Albany area, it is hysterically funny to see Angelina Jolie running along what's clearly a street in D.C., vaults a railing and comes down on the 787 underpasses, thanks to the miracle of film editing. When I was in high school, I actually saw some of the location shooting for The Way We Were, which was partly shot down at Union College. And actually, I did meet Robert Redford very, very briefly. I did not meet Barbara Streisand, but I was able to watch her behind a rope line while she did a scene. And again, when the movie was finally shown in local theaters, people were like gaga-ing over, seeing local locations that they recognized, which I think always thrills an audience.
Oh, yeah, when they could spot something and maybe see their friends in the back or remember something or a specific building and something like that. Yeah, absolutely. I remember you always saying to me, Jim, that the most excited I ever was at one of these preview screenings was Cars 2. Because Cars was my favorite Pixar movie, still is, and I just could not wait for Cars 2 to be released. And it was a Saturday morning screening, Saturday before it opened. I did my segment at the TV station. I rushed over to the theater. I think it was Cross Gates. And I remember being so excited. And then they were playing a bunch of trailers, and they even played like an ad for Disney Channel shows. And I was like, let's get the movie going.
Yes, you were very hyped that morning. You were. Yeah.
What are some of the other crazy experiences? Anything happened that was wacky, out of the ordinary, or something that sticks out of your mind of your decades of movie-going experience?
I remember in 68, I saw the original Planet of the Apes in a theater. I went to a matinee on a Saturday. It was a crowded theater. At that point, I was deemed old enough by my parents to be like left off at the theater and picked up afterwards. And I just remember the audience had been very into the movie from the get-go. And it was an exciting action movie. The ape makeup, which may look old-fashioned to audiences now, believe me, in 68, we'd never seen anything like it. The audience was completely sucked into the movie. And when we get to I guess it's okay with a movie this old to mention, to not worry about spoilers too much. The climactic shot when Charlton Heston and Linda Harrison get to the ruins of the Statue of Liberty, and we suddenly realize where this movie has been taking place all that time. I had never up to that point in my life seen an audience so stunned.
That is an iconic moment. It's one of the most iconic moments in cinema.
And having had the chance to see that with an audience that did not know it was coming, that was really one of the defining moments in my early movie-going career. That was just, as I said, the audience's socks were blown off, and you could just tell. I mean, people, and I was by myself, people that had gone with somebody, there was a lot of conversation among audience members on the way out of that theater. And I just was like, oh my God, I can't believe I saw that. There's a movie I saw in college called The Sentinel, which is not a well-known movie now, and it really doesn't deserve to be. It's a very pedestrian horror movie based on a novel that was an okay novel, but a lot better than the book. But the movie is one of those things where that brownstone apartment building in New York happens to be built on the gateway to hell. I mean, you've really got to question your realtor carefully about things like this. There are way too many properties to look attractive on the outside, and they are on the gateway to hell. And this was one of them. And at the end of the movie, the minions of hell rise up and are crawling through the apartment building. And Michael Winner, the director, had actually cast actual deformed people from circus sideshows to do those parts. The audience was stunned, not in a good way. You could feel a communal numbness going through the audience. These days, I would say, no, they didn't. I was like, that doesn't look like makeup. Mm-hmm. And I found out later, it was not makeup. These people were, in fact, recruited from sideshows and hospitals. It's a numbingly horrifying moment. As I say, I don't think in a good way.
Right.
It's funny. Yeah. You look at the people that were in that movie. Christina Raines, who did not have a big career, was the lead, but it also included Chris Sarandon and Ava Gardner and Martin Balsam and Burgess Meredith and Jose Ferrer and John Carradine were all running around in this turkey. But it's that was a moment that I really remember, and I could tell it. You know, the audience, I think, had actually been a little bit bored for a lot of the movie, shocked a couple of times. There's some violence. There's a little gratuitous sex in it. But they turned on the movie at the end, and you could tell. I mean, they kind of got angry.
Yeah, sometimes those negative experiences or negative shock or disappointment from a twist that happens in a movie or something like that stands out in your mind as well. I'm trying to think movie twists that the audience or you didn't agree with, and you were just like, I've had it with this. I can't believe this happened.
In the grand scheme of all the movies I've seen, certainly, although now you're asking me cold, I'm not going to come up with one. But I have certainly seen, like, oh, come on, people. We can do better than that.
Yeah.
And of course, as we know, like, you know, horror movies are my particular specialty. And you know, if a horror movie doesn't work, it's either dull or funny.
Yeah, it could either be cheesy or low.
Yeah, and then you have the weird ones where it kind of goes both ways. Back in the late 70s, George Romero finally did a sequel to the original Night of the Living Dead. It was the original Dawn of the Dead. It's been remade since. But the original was one of the first times a movie had ever been released unrated to avoid the X rating it would have gotten. And that would have been, it would have been rated X for violence. And the audience went into shock with some of the early shock scenes in the movie. And then oddly, as they started getting used to it, because later in the movie, more and more of the violence happens to the zombies. Like one walks into a helicopter rotor and the top of his head gets lopped off on camera and the audience burst out laughing. You can shock an audience with a lot of gore early on and then they get used to it and they will start laughing at it.
One just popped into my mind just thinking about experiences we've had over the past decade or so. I remember Sony said they wanted me to see American Hustle. And they said, we can have you see American Hustle to vote for the Critics' Choice Awards. Obviously, know the Bradley Cooper movie, so glad he got nominated for the Oscar for that film. But we need to fill the theater enough to have sort of a quota. This was a little different. It couldn't just be us. They needed to invite other people. So they invited about 40 people or so into this Saturday morning screening of American Hustle over at the Spectrum. And I remember you walking out of it, I think with Susan, and you said, "This is the best movie I've seen this year." Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. And I did love that movie. It surprised me on a lot of levels. I loved the acting in it. I thought Christian Bale showed... that was a fearless performance. Just to have that ridiculous comb over was kind of fearless. And I thought Jennifer Lawrence was very good. And quite frankly, there was virtually nothing about that movie I didn't like.
Yeah, Amy Adams, amazing in it. Nicest person, and in so many movies we have seen in theaters over the years. I hope we get back to a place where the studios can say, hey, we want you and Jim and other critics and everybody to see these movies in theaters for voting consideration and to set up these audience advanced screenings again. They've been a huge part of our lives for the past decade plus. How do you feel about going back to the theater and if advanced screenings can really happen again?
I mean, that's been on my mind a lot lately. I think, as it would be with anyone for whom movies has been such a big part of their life. I already know, and you do, you've heard the same stories that some theater chains are already getting ready for reopening and are literally ripping seats out of theaters to help with social distancing. Movies were meant to be seen with audiences, and I don't think there's any substitute for that shared experience. It's not like the electricity of the live performance with a play or a concert, but there is still something about sharing the experience of the movie with other people. And as I said, you know, horror movies particularly, they're always better with audiences. Revenues are going to be down simply because they're not going to be able to sell as many tickets. And revenues are going to be down because the amount of cleaning they're going to have to do between showings, I think, is going to cut down on the number of show times they're going to be able to do in any given day. And I've already wondered about, you mentioned, Tenet is apparently going to come out in theaters this summer. I don't know what that movie costs, but Christopher Nolan doesn't make low-budget movies anymore at this point.
Right.
A lot of the studios have got some very expensive inventory that's pending release. People who keep tabs on these things are aware of the fact that 20th Century and James Cameron are in the middle of making four sequels to Avatar at a reported investment of $1 billion. And these movies are being shot, if I have it correct, they're being shot in high frame rate digital 3D. These are clearly meant to be seen in a theater setting.
Right.
And they're not going to be able to sell as many tickets. It's just not going to be possible. Well, like the way the studios reacted to the perceived TV crisis in the 50s was one of their major recourses was to make very big budget movies, epic scale, in color, widescreen. The biblical epic really took off at that point. They figure we'll give them size and color and flash and dazzle that they can't get on TV. I think they're going to have to go the other way because they had unlimited theater capacity, at least theoretically. We don't have that now. And I don't think we're going to have it for a couple of years, if ever again. Theater, they're going to have to sell fewer tickets. There's going to be fewer showings. I think they're going to have to start making smaller movies. I think people want to go to the movies. I think they're going to be scared for a little while, but I think the confidence level will eventually start to return. I think the theaters have the ability to convince them that the theaters are clean, that social distancing can be observed, and eventually, hopefully, we'll get a vaccine to coronavirus and people will feel safer being out. But whether or not we're ever going to see the packed multiplex the way it's been for the last couple of decades, remember, I mean, when I was a teenager, I mean, we had the Old Town Theater on Route 9 that I think seated 750 per showing. The Hellman's Theater on Washington Avenue was that big. I mean, we're not going to be seeing anything like that for quite a while, I don't think.
The smaller movies, I know a lot of them have been on VOD the last couple of months. You seek them out on pay-per-view or get them in a digital way, and this is how people have been able to find them. So are you saying that more of these kinds in a theater will attract more people, at least out of the gate, and sort of build up to the blockbusters?
Maybe, although I think they're going to have to be a little bit bigger than the video. Some of these video on demand ones are real micro budget. I mean, sometimes they'll talk about something like Ouija being a $5 million movie and they'll say that's micro budget. Some of the ones that are being shot for the video on demand market are they would consider $5 million like, you know, a James Cameron movie.
Right.
I think to get people into the theaters, you have to convince them that it's worth the theatrical experience. But back again in the 50s, when TV was threatening the industry, the other thing they did, in addition to the big blockbuster epics, was they made grittier, more adult movies that didn't have to be done necessarily on a huge budget, but they tackled more controversial themes. They were getting a little bit franker about adult relationships and alcoholism and drug abuse and racism and just heavier hitting themes than they had been willing to tackle for a while. And so you had some of those both happening in the 50s, things like A Face in the Crowd or Days of Wine and Roses is actually 60s, but like the psychological westerns, like The Gunfighter that started coming up in the 1950s, Samuel Fuller's movies, which tended to be rather gritty and down and dirty and sometimes shocked audiences. They would do stuff like that because TV wouldn't or couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. So we may actually see the four quadrant tentpole, you know, may have had its day for a while, but maybe we'll start seeing more niche oriented movies that currently don't get a lot of play in theaters.
Yeah.
And that might not be a bad thing.
Right. It might not be a bad thing at all. Yeah, that perspective is the first that I've heard, because a lot of people have said, oh, the thing that's going to bring people back are the giant movies, the ones that people, you know, have been clamoring for, have been waiting for. But quality films will also get people to go, and you're one of the first perspectives I've heard on that, but I think it makes a lot of sense. And I hope that we get to go back and have critic screenings and have audience screenings when it feels right and when it feels safe, and for the studios to get back to doing this for us, because we love what we do. We love going to the movies. We love talking about movies, reviewing films, and sharing our thoughts with everybody. And we've had about a decade or so of good times at the cinema, and I hope we can get back to that very soon.
I do too. As I say, these movies that cost $200 to $300 million to make and another $100 million to market and distribute. As I say, I don't know how they're going to make their money back on it right now when they just simply cannot sell the same number of tickets they used to. But as I say, right now they've got a lot. As you know, there's a Wonder Woman sequel that's waiting for release. There's a James Bond movie that's waiting for release, and these are expensive pictures.
They are, yes. Wonder Woman, August 14 as of now, No Time to Die, the smart move to go from April into November. I remember when that news was coming out, and it was like, whoa, you're going all the way there? Not July, not August? You're going all the way to November? But I guess it ended up being, as of now, the smart decision, though I'm not quite sure how things are going to be in November. So the award season timing could be interesting with some of the smaller films that debuted at film festivals last year and early this year that could have a chance. But we'll see if they're able to come out either in theaters or on digital. Yeah, the award season situation, really unpredictable. The Academy is saying, you know, we're going to allow digital films that we're supposed to have a theatrical release if you can't, to still qualify, but how many of those will studios actually want to put out in some way before the end of the year? I'm not quite sure about that either. It's a very fluid, unpredictable situation.
And of course, one thing you did call, because I remember you were one of the first voices I heard predicting a resurgence of the drive-in movie theater as a probable result of the current conditions, and based on, I guess, what's happening with the few local drive-ins we have around here, would seem to be bearing you out already. Of course, drive-ins can't be a year-round business in a lot of the country.
Correct.
And they don't charge the same amount. They don't charge the same ticket prices. But if drive-ins ended up being the future of theatrical motion pictures, what does that do to the traditional Christmas movie season?
Correct. Yes. And that's why we needed, you know, Governor Cuomo to get the drive-ins open as quickly as possible. And he finally did. And we appreciate it because they are doing really well. Some parts of the country, California, you can have 12 months a year drive-ins, year-round drive-ins. But here in upstate New York, you know, we lost basically a month, maybe a month and a week from in April, and finally the middle of May, will go to about the middle of October, possibly, with the drive-ins, and then have to be shut down. Yeah, what happens to the Christmas season for the movie-going experience? Yeah, I think drive-ins will be a key component, and I'm so glad that they are having this resurgence. It's just a matter of what studios can say, all right, I'm going to release the film in as many indoor theaters as possible, and let's put it in the drive-ins, and let's put it in on VOD. Yeah, I'm glad about the drive-ins, but I don't know if it'll be the number one go-to only source for the movies. I think the indoor theaters will open back up at some point, but I hope they continue to be a key component in the years to come.
Yeah, I have some fond memories of going to drive-ins as a kid. In fact, I think the first time I ever went to one was a very odd double bill of Beach Blanket Bingo and Zulu.
Yeah, you see, drive-ins, it's a different kind of indoor experience in the doors of your car. But it is an indoor experience, and so glad that families can go to these drive-ins right now in this in-between time before the indoor movie theaters open up again. Jim Dixon, this has been great. Thank you so much for your insights and for taking a trip down memory lane with me. You have been a core part of my movie world throughout my career. Thank you so much for being on Cinema Stories today.
My pleasure, Jackson. Thanks for having me.
You are welcome. To follow Jim, you can do so on Twitter at Dixon Jim. He's also on Facebook and Instagram, filminquiry.com, jim-dixon.com, and a member of the Online Film Critics Society. Hopefully you'll still have your Online Film Critics Society awards at the end of the year to vote on the films that have been out either in theaters or on VOD and streaming.
I'm sure we will. We change the rules a little bit every year, so we'll find a way to accommodate this.
Nice. Stay safe, stay well, and I hope we're back in indoor theaters very soon.
You too, Jackson. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm Lights, Camera, Jackson. Tune in again for another episode of Cinema Stories very soon, where we bring on colleagues in the film critic world to talk about indoor movie theater experiences and what's happening right now. You can follow me on Twitter at LCJ Reviews, Instagram at LightsCamJackson, and the website is lights-camera-jackson.com. Thank you so much for listening to episode 2 of Cinema Stories. We'll be back again very soon. I'm Lights, Camera, Jackson.